You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, Celeste Headlee. And Todd Zwillick is here with me today. John Hockenberry's away for the holidays. And Todd, you know, we have been reporting on the wheeling and dealing, the backs and forths and arguments over healthcare for months.
Yeah.
This has been the centerpiece of everything that's been going on down in Washington. And it kind of looks like it's winding up, right?
Well, it finally came down to it over the weekend in a blizzard. Senator,
you had to sit there in the Senate offices.
Trudged up Capitol Hill into the Senate. You know, it was funny. Everyone had suits on the top, boots on the bottom. That's how it worked in the Senate over the weekend.
Well, at least one person is very happy today.
After a nearly century-long struggle, we are on the cusp of making health care reform a reality in the United States of America.
And it's true. Health care reform, the idea of it began with Teddy Roosevelt. So it's been a long time coming.
Right. And what they've got now is a glide path to getting this finished, or so it seems.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talked a lot. There was a lot of arguments over the public option. In the end, it's not there.
The public option is not there. This was a political agreement. You just couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate. You know, I think a lot of people knew that from the start, that a public option just wasn't going to survive all of the moderate and conservative Democrats.
So what did we get instead? We have the government-run two companies. One, at least, is nonprofit.
Right. But when you say government-run, not government-run in the sense that Medicare is government-run. These are private plans, but they're administered by the government. So basically, they're private nonprofit plans that have to answer to the government to make sure their premiums don't go too high, they're not paying executives too much, they're not wasting money on advertising, things like that.
And they're going to cover the same number of people that the public option would have covered.
They cover the exact same number, 31 million new people covered under this bill without the public option. The only difference was the public option, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would have done it for about $25 billion less.
Less. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that held us up for so long was Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska wanted stronger language in abortion. And I guess he kind of got it. But in the end, I mean, tell me if you agree with me or not, the language that's in there pretty much doesn't change the standing regulations already in law.
It doesn't change them substantively. Basically, nobody likes this deal. The pro-choice groups on the left and the anti-abortion groups on the right all attacked it at once. The Senate Democratic leadership says that's how you know it's a true compromise, because everybody hates it.
Because everyone hates it. Well, here's Senator Richard Burr.
I could go further on the abortion language. I think the original language that Harry Reid had actually was better than what was negotiated. But you've got to compliment Ben Nelson for playing The Price is Right.
He says he was playing The Price is Right. I'd said let's make a deal, but yeah.
Yeah, and he's basically impugning Senator Nelson's motives, saying that he used abortion as a bargaining chip to get a good deal for Nebraska. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but Nebraska did get a good deal. They got more money for Medicaid. This deal expands Medicaid, but Nebraska is the one state that never has to pay for the expansion itself, ever. It's all paid by the federal government.
Oh, that's good for him. You know, quickly, the Congressional Budget Office weighed in. It's $871 billion, which is more than the previous version of this bill, but in the end, it still saves money on the deficit.
Right.
There's a larger, expanded, I should say, tax credit for small businesses. And here's the odd thing: they took out the language on taxing plastic surgery, but they're taxing tanning beds.
Yeah, the Botox is out. But there's a 10% surtax now on indoor tanning services. They say this is a double good policy. The indoor tanning causes cancer. It's not good for you, so why not discourage it? I think it raises about $2.5 billion over 10 years. Not a great revenue raiser, but it does prove that the plastic surgeons probably have a better lobby than the tanning industry.
Well, we're joined again by Theda Scotchpole. She's a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University. She joins us from her home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Theda, let's set the tanning beds aside for just a second, but they managed to get 60 votes. They have two more procedural votes, but what do you think? Is this basically the bill that's going to go before the full Senate on Christmas Eve?
Oh, it absolutely is. I don't think they could change an inch of it if they want to get to 60.
And tell me about this legislation. Do you think it is a good piece of legislation?
It's historic. It's 100 years have gone by as reformers have fought for the principle that government should be involved in access to affordable health care for virtually all Americans, and particularly lower-income Americans. And it's a giant step in that direction.
Are there winners and losers? I mean, they expanded the small business tax credit. It looks actually like that particular piece of it looks like a good thing to me. There's going to be more businesses that are able to get a full credit. Is that to make small businesses a winner here?
Yes, given that we're trying to build on and extend employer-provided insurance for working-aged people and their families. Small businesses are given a lot of help to do that in this bill.
So who are the losers? I mean, beyond the people who use tanning beds regularly, who loses out in this bill?
Well, it puts in place a framework for regulating private insurance companies that they're nervous about. Of course, they're going to get a lot of new customers at the same time. Let's think about this as changing the nature of the politics going forward. It'll be a politics of how we make sure that we afford health care while everybody's in the system. But that's different from the past.
Seda, there are a lot of middle-class people, union workers with high-cost plans who are going to be paying higher taxes. You could make an argument that that's better for the system, but they're going to feel a hurt, at least in the short term, aren't they?
Well, there were some pretty important exemptions written in, and I think that there'll be some of that. But we'll see. Maybe there'll be some adjustments in where the revenues come from when they do the conference between the House and the Senate versions.
So, you know, Theta, I mean, professor of, you're both a professor of government.
No, just call me Theta. That's fine.
Government and sociology. So break this down for me as a piece of legislation that affects us both as a government and as a culture. How is this going to affect people's daily lives on their social level? Are we just going to end up having people who are better medically covered? Is this going to make a better way of life for Americans?
When it's fully implemented, it's a long time before it's fully implemented, but when it is, we should have at least some degree of assistance through government so that everyone can afford a basic level of health insurance coverage. That makes a huge difference in the security of regular people's lives in America.
Well, you heard President Obama talking about how this bill comes after almost 100 years of struggling for health care reform that began with Teddy Roosevelt's call for this kind of thing. So tell me, if this is historic, and it is also a baby step in that a lot of people feel like this healthcare reform is going to get tinkered with in the years ahead. Is it historic in that any step, even a baby one on healthcare, is a milestone?
This is a big change in the framework, like Social Security was in 1935. It took 25 years for Social Security to grow into what it became, but they started in 35. We'll look back and say we started in 2009. Toward affordable, accessible health insurance for all Americans.
Well, there's your takeaway. Healthcare reform began in 2009. Theda Scotchpole is a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University. Thanks.